Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Linda Duckworth, past president of the League of Women Voters of Nebraska. The title of her presentation will be Lady Arrested for Voting, Susan B. Anthony, the Woman Who Changed the Mind of the Nation. Ms. Duckworth will present her talk in the personage and in period costume of women's rights champion Susan B. Anthony. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Sunday afternoon, March 17, 2013, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Durham Museum, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. In her over 60 years of campaigning for the basic rights and equality of women in 19th-century United States, Miss Anthony fought not only for the right to vote, but also the right for women to independently own property, to sign legal contracts, to pursue an education and a career, and lesser known, along with several other women's rights advocates of the time, including Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Alice Paul, to voice their total opposition to abortion. In an article published in the Washington Post in May 2010, Marjorie Dannenfelser writes, quote, that Susan B. Anthony was passionate and logical in her arguments against abortion. The revolution was her brainchild, co-founded with Elizabeth Cady Stanton, in a weekly women's rights newspaper that acted as the official voice of the National Woman Suffrage Association, and in which appeared many of her writings alongside those of her like-minded colleagues. Most logical people would agree, then, that writings signed by A in a paper that Anthony funded and published were a reflection of her own opinions. In one House editorial signed A, published in The Revolution on July 8, 1869, she wrote, quote, guilty? Yes. No matter what the motive, love of ease, or a desire to save from suffering the unborn innocent, the woman is awfully guilty who commits the deed. It will burden her conscience in life. It will burden her soul in death. But, oh, thrice guilty is he who drove her to the desperation which impelled her to the crime, unquote. Here now to introduce a program in which we'll hear the progression of Susan B. Anthony's efforts to gain the right to vote for all women in America, culminating in the passage of the 19th Amendment to the Constitution, which was certified by Secretary of State Bainbridge Colby on August 26, 1920, is Mick Hale, Director of Education at the Durham Museum.
Our program today, our presenter is Linda Duckworth, and she is currently the president of the League of Women Voters for the state of Nebraska. And she will be presenting Lady Arrested for Voting, Susan B. Anthony, and she will be doing it in first person. So she will be coming out and sharing you Susan's story, as well as making some comment on some other folks who were involved in the suffrage movement as Susan B. Anthony. Linda did a great deal of research and obviously has a great deal of passion for the topic and the subject of women's voting and politics. And she did speak here a couple of weeks ago doing this program, and we've just been very, very pleased and thrilled that she has been a part of our programming for this exhibit this spring. So with that, again, I thank you for coming. We will have some Q&A following her presentation, and we will have microphones, so if you'd like to ask a question, I do ask that you call for the microphone. There will be me and another gentleman that will be taking care of that. So with that, I give you Susan B. Anthony.
Thank you. It has been most gratifying to see in the past 100 years and more how people, women especially, have celebrated my life and accomplishments. They say I worked tirelessly. Well, truthfully, I sometimes felt weary and very discouraged, but it has been said that I worked tirelessly and continuously for women's rights for more than 60 years. I'm sure it was the willingness to plod on and on in search of justice that gained me so much attention. You may be interested to know what others thought of me as a person. I'll tell you now, my tenacity and single-mindedness sometimes made me hard to live with. Let's just see how people did describe me. Tall, broad-shouldered, grim. A cantankerous disposition. A domineering nature. Now, these words were used by my friends, people who had some affection for me. And the persons who didn't know me and certainly didn't consider me a friend, they used words like a dangerous crank, disgraceful creature. Newspapers poked fun of me in cartoons that showed a half-dressed, scowling hag smoking a thick black cigar. And what did I think of myself? I was self-conscious about my appearance. I had had whooping cough when I was a child, and it left me somewhat cross-eyed. Other than that, I thought I was equal to any man and should be treated as such. You could give my father, Daniel Anthony, credit for that kind of thinking. He was a Quaker and a businessman who owned a cotton mill in Adams, Massachusetts. He was unusual in his time in that he lived by his conscience first, the rules of society second. He had shocked his neighbors by marrying my mother, Lucy Reed. She was a high-spirited Baptist girl, not a Quaker. The neighbors were shocked again when he broke the dress plain rule in wintertime. He was cold and woolen scarves were warm, so he wore woolen scarves, bright red ones, which kept the biting winds from his ears, but not the Quaker scoldings. He even managed to perplex my mother when he brought us children up to believe that girls were different from boys, but not inferior. Once, when I was 12, he permitted me to work in his cotton mill, taking the place of a spooler woman who was ill. It was an enlightening experience for me. For 2 weeks, I wound cotton thread onto spools, and at the end of that time, my father paid me the same amount that the spooler would have earned, $3. I gave half the money to my sister Guelma and spent the rest on some pale blue cups and saucers for my mother. And what was my mother like? She had to give up all thoughts of singing and dancing and wearing fancy dresses when she married a Quaker. She was well-loved by my father, yet it was her lot to work from sun up to sundown. At the time when Guelma, Hannah, and I were small, my mother had to prepare meals for our family plus 11 boarding mill workers. There was also the house cleaning, washing, ironing, bread baking, spinning, weaving, knitting, and mending that had to be done continually. Where she found the time to bear 5 more children, I don't know. Well, perhaps it was seeing her hard at work that made me question whether I ever wanted to marry. She and most married women at that time had a life that aged them prematurely if it didn't kill them in childbirth. After my experience at the mill, I said to my father one evening at dinner, "Why isn't Sally Ann in charge of the spoolers at the mill? She can untangle the thread better than Elijah." Even with all his independent ideas, my father could not imagine a woman as the boss. Yet, even though he couldn't look that far into the future, he could see and correct some inequities of the sexes. For instance, when my male teacher refused to teach me long division on the grounds that I was female, my father set up a neighborhood school in our 15-room house. He hired Miss Mary Perkins, a young woman who had studied at an advanced female seminary, to be our first teacher. We girls learned to make quilts and hem ruffles, of course, but Miss Perkins also taught us higher math and had us recite poetry. My sister Guelma and I then went on to attend Miss Deborah Molson's Select Seminary for Females in Philadelphia. For my father believed his daughters should be self-supporting, just like his sons. And indeed, the only profession open to genteel women at that time was teaching. We had been at Miss Molson's less than a year, however, when father came to fetch my sister and me home. His business had fallen on hard times, and he was bankrupt. Everything was sold at auction, from the factory itself to the flour and sugar in our pantry. It was humiliating to see our personal belongings sold. Our family moved to a small village aptly called Hardscrabble, and my diary held such entries as, Monday, did a large washing. Tuesday, spent today at the spinning wheel. Wednesday, baked 21 loaves of bread. Friday, wove 3 yards of carpet today. My sisters Guelma and Hannah got married, and after hearing of a young woman who had married a widower with 6 children, I wrote this. I should think any female would rather live and die an old maid. Now, living and dying an old maid never looked unattractive to me, although that was certainly an odd attitude in those days. Few people really believed anyone who said she'd rather remain single. For how could any woman prefer not to have a husband to support her and give her a position in the community? I did have offers of marriage, which I refused, for it would have been hard when I believed I was equal to a man to be married to a man who held the prevailing belief that women were not citizens, but subjects. To be the partner of someone who agreed that women should not have the right to vote or the right to buy a business, sign a contract, inherit money, or even be legal guardians of their own children. Back then, if a married woman had to work, her wages went directly to her husband. I noticed all these things and began to have my own opinions about the fairness or unfairness of such practices. In 1839, when I was 19, I took my first teaching job away from home. For the next 6 years, I taught school and lived frugally so that I could send money home to father and mother. Then in 1845, my family moved to Rochester, New York, where my father once again found prosperity. Now that I could spend my salary on myself, I discovered clothes. Here's something you probably don't know already about Susan B. Anthony. I have a new pearl straw gypsy hat trimmed in white ribbon with fringe on one edge and a pink satin stripe on the other, with a few white roses and green leaves for inside trimming. I bought a plum-colored dress, which everyone admits to be the sweetest thing entirely. I wonder if my sisters do not feel rather sad because they are married and cannot have nice clothes. During that time, I visited at home as often as I could. My parents' house was frequently full of lively people, luminaries such as Frederick Douglass and William Lloyd Garrison, discussing the issues of the day. As I listened to the discussions and debate over Sunday dinner, I longed to fight the wrongs of society. I began to take an active part in battles against slavery and drunkenness. I attended meetings of the abolitionists and joined the Daughters of Temperance. I met women of similar beliefs, such as Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Lucy Stone, Lucretia Mott, Reverend Antoinette Brown, and Amelia Bloomer. I was warmly encouraged by my father as I gave every power of my being to reform. I attended a women's rights convention in 1852 in Syracuse, New York, where speakers asked, "Why are women forbidden to own property?" And there were murmurs of agreement. "Why are they refused the advantages of higher education?" And the excitement was building. "Why are they not man's equal before the law?" The response was thunderous. The convention demanded free speech and the right of women to vote. This, by all means, caused a stir in church pulpits and other meeting rooms across the country. Sermons such as... "The terrible spectacle of immodest females who abandon their families to speak in public, and any men who encourage such women are not true friends. They are simply dragging womanhood from the high pedestal on which it belongs and trampling it in the dust." We reform-minded women didn't really want to be on a pedestal. We were aware that that figurative high stand was hindering our freedom as much as if we had actually been placed in a corner among the ferns and figurines. We were considered as handsome as the ferns and figurines, thanks to the extreme fashions of the time, but the price we paid in discomfort was great. A stiff, tight corset, then corset cover and long drawers. Next came 5 or 6 heavy, quilted, stiffly starched petticoats. Finally, there was a dress with a high neck, long sleeves, tight bodice, and full skirt that swept the ground. No wonder we were rarely seen riding bicycles, which I remind you is an excellent form of exercise and a form of transportation. And no wonder my friends Elizabeth and Lucy convinced me that dress reform was an important part of the women's rights movement. Yet, as restrictive as my dresses were, I considered them flattering. But I reluctantly put them away to stitch a loose dress and bloomers. The new costume was extolled by Amelia Bloomer in the magazine she published, but most men and women termed it shocking, and women who wore it were tormented by unruly mobs of men and boys. And by torment, I mean chunks of bricks called brickbats and rotten tomatoes, and not rotten tomatoes, were thrown at us. I found their treatment extremely humiliating, but felt I must be true to my principles. But then, after wearing it to a New York State Teachers Association meeting where I earnestly spoke for women's equality, I decided it was a mistake. I felt the outfit called attention to a speaker's clothes instead of permitting the audience to concentrate on her words. I decided to fight for one reform at a time, and within a year, I had put away the bloomer dress. At last, I completely gave up teaching and dedicated everything to equal rights for women. The first need I decided to address was getting the New York legislature to allow women to own property. I began touring the state, making speeches and obtaining signatures on petitions. After 5 months, I had visited 54 counties, but still needed more signatures. My sister and I started out again, and that winter I wrote to my mother. Wendy's Station, January 14, 1856, 12:30 p.m. We stopped at a little tavern where the landlady was not yet 20 and had a baby 15 months old. Her supper dishes were not washed and her baby was crying, but she was equal to the occasion. She rocked the little thing to sleep, washed the dishes, and got our supper. She gave us her warm bedroom to sleep in, and on a row of pegs hung the loveliest embroidered petticoats and baby clothes, all the work of that young woman's fingers, while on a rack was her ironing, perfectly done, wrought undersleeves, baby dresses, embroidered underwear, etc. She prepared a 6 o'clock breakfast for us, fried pork, mashed potatoes, mince pie, and for me, at my especial request, a plate of delicious baked sweet apples and a pitcher of rich milk. Now, for the moral of this story. When we came to pay our bill, the dolt of a husband took the money and put it in his pocket. He had not lifted a hand to lighten that woman's burdens, but had sat and talked with the men in the barroom, not even caring for the baby, yet the law gives him the right to every dollar she earns, and when she needs 2 cents to buy a darning needle, she has to ask him and explain what she wants it for. In February, I traveled to the state capitol in Albany to present to the legislature petitions signed by some 10,000 women who asked to be given the legal right to control their own income and have custody of their own children. The legislators were not moved. One speaker said, "Are we going to give the least countenance to claims so preposterous, disgraceful, and criminal? Are we going to put the stamp of truth upon libel here set forth that men and women are to be equal? We know that God created man as a representative of the race." And then, in a speech which caused much knee-slapping and gales of laughter, "The ladies always have the best place and choicest tidbit at the table. They have the best seats in the carriages, the warmest place in winter, and coolest in summer. A lady's dress costs 3 times as much as that of a gentleman, and with the prevailing fashion, one lady occupies 3 times as much space in the world as a gentleman. It has thus appeared that if there is any inequality or oppression in the case, the gentlemen are the sufferers." Not an auspicious beginning, I thought. I found it so discouraging, in fact, that my friend, Mrs. Stanton, urged me to stop crusading. This is what she wrote. "Let the world alone a while. You need rest, too." But I wrote back, "All this is but the noise and dust of the wagon bringing the harvest home. These things must be, and happy are they who see clearly to the end." And let it be remembered that Elizabeth Stanton's and my differences were few, our friendship great, and that many times when she longed to be out there making speeches and stirring up enthusiasm, I would stay behind and help care for her numerous children. And, of course, I chose to continue. I gave a speech entitled, "Why the Sexes Should Be Educated Together." Men and women alike were scandalized. More brickbats and tomatoes. But I relentlessly appeared before legislatures and took my equal rights campaign door to door. And finally, in 1860, the New York State Married Woman's Property and Guardianship Law came to fruition. The enactment of that law is considered my first major legislative victory. I was 40 years old. With the outbreak of the Civil War in 1861, women's rights took second place. Mrs. Stanton and I organized the Women's National Loyal League, mobilizing petitions that gathered some 400,000 signatures and forcing passage of the 13th Amendment abolishing slavery. During that time, I worked for the vote for former slaves, believing that when they achieved it, women would be granted the vote also. In 1866, the 14th Amendment was passed, but it was too weak to work in the southern states, so again, we set to work. At last, the 15th Amendment was passed, but again, women were not specifically given the right to vote. On the other hand, we were not specifically denied the right to vote. So, on November 1st, 1872, I and my sisters Guelma, Hannah, and Mary walked into a shoemaker's shop that was the polling place in our district of Rochester. "We are here to register for the vote," I said. I was afraid the election inspector would have an attack of apoplexy. When he refuses, I presented to him a copy of the Constitution of the United States and slowly read the 14th and 15th Amendments. I said, "Show me where it specifically denies women the right to vote." After much sputtering and argument, we were allowed to register. I then found 46 other women who were willing to register and a lawyer to defend me in case problems arose, which they assuredly did. Of the 50 of us who had registered, 15 were actually brave enough to go and vote. Of course, we made the headlines across the country, as well as editorials, which were mostly against us. On Monday, November 18th, I was arrested. The charge, voting. As a matter of fact, all 15 of us were arrested, as well as the inspectors who had allowed us to vote. We were each held in bail of $500, which I refused to pay. However, my attorney, Mr. Selden, paid it, and I was released. As I awaited trial, I spoke 29 times on the equal right of all citizens to the ballot. I lectured in Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, as well as in many cities in New York. I often paraphrased the Constitution in my speeches. For example, I said, "It was we, the people, not we, the white male citizens, nor yet we, the male citizens, but we, the people, who formed this union. And we formed it to give the blessings of liberty to the whole people, women as well as men." My speeches were thoroughly covered by the press. Some newspapers published mocking stories and cartoons, while others, such as the Rochester Express, were supportive. On June 17, 1873, I was brought to trial before Ward Hunt, a judge well known for his strong anti-feminist views. He first of all refused to let me testify on my own behalf. He then astonished everyone by directing the jury to find a vote of guilty. Mr. Selden leaped to his feet in protest, stating it was up to the jury to determine my guilt or innocence. Then Judge Hunt discharged the jury, at which time I rose in protest and continued to protest, despite his many objections. But at last I sat down, and he sentenced me to pay a fine of $100 plus the costs of the prosecution. And this is what I said. "May it please your honor, I will never pay a dollar of your unjust penalty. And I shall earnestly and persistently continue to urge all women to the practical recognition of the old revolutionary maxim, resistance to tyranny is obedience to God." I never paid the fine, and my 14 friends never went to trial. But I did receive offers of financial help and letters of sympathy from all over the country. It was the encouragement I needed to continue working for suffrage. As for my travels throughout the country, perhaps you'd be interested to know that I visited the state of Nebraska 3 different times, in 1867 with Mrs. Stanton, in 1871 when the legislators were kind enough to extend the privilege of the floor to me, and again in 1882. In fact, in the fall of 1882, I spent nearly 2 months in Nebraska visiting numerous towns and cities and 3 county fairs. This is what Mr. Othman Abbott wrote many years later. "Miss Anthony traveled out to Nebraska herself that year, and we were happy when she stayed at our house and spoke at a public meeting in Grand Island. It was a very splendid meeting for those days, and Miss Anthony herself seemed pleased with it. I ought to chronicle one remark she made after she had shaken hands with the last person in the audience who lingered to meet her or talk with her. Mrs. Abbott said as we walked away that it must be very hard to have to shake hands with so many people. Miss Anthony replied as quick as a flash, 'Oh, my dear, if you could only know how much easier it is today to shake hands with people than it was in the old days when no one wanted to shake hands with me.' Then Mr. Abbott goes on to say, Ms. Anthony also helped the cause greatly by sending us a very fine German speaker, Mrs. Clara Nyman. She came, I believe, from Brooklyn, New York, and she did good work among those who could only be reached in the German language. Mrs. Nyman also stayed at our house, and we enjoyed her visit as well. There was much to discuss and plan for passage here of the Woman Suffrage Amendment. Unfortunately, the amendment failed. Had Nebraskans accepted it, the state would have been the first to give women the vote. As I continued my speaking and organizing across the country, I supported all efforts to bring about the vote for women, and especially a federal law allowing women the right to vote. And gradually, my admirers became numerous. By 1890, the brickbats and tomatoes had been replaced by bouquets and testimonials. Newspapers invited me to write editorials. Politicians asked my advice. And I was stunned to find myself a wildly popular speaker at the Chicago World's Fair in 1893. In 1900, when I turned 80, I noted that I had been president of the Woman Suffrage Association of America for more than 20 years and turned it over to Carrie Chapman Catt. At my last convention in 1905, I said, "The fight must not cease. You must see that it does not stop." My last words to a large audience were, "Failure is impossible." And I was right. I didn't live to see suffrage achieved, but I did see women and girls riding bicycles and dressing a little more comfortably, attending college, and earning money that was theirs to keep if they wished. Perhaps fittingly, one century after my birth and 14 years after my death, the 19th Amendment was added to our Constitution. August 26, 1920. The right of the citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. Congress shall have power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation. Thank you. If you have questions, you're welcome to let me hear them.
And I do need to note that this isn't like traditional Chautauqua where Linda answers questions in character. As I mentioned in the intro, Linda's motivation behind this was just her involvement in politics and the cause and which led her to her research.
No, Mick, it was not that. Asked me to do it, and I sort of just fell into it.
All right, so that's where I was going. Well, you know, give a little bit
go
of background.
Ahead and go with it if
well,
you
I was
going
to say, give a little background as to what led you to this type of education or this type of program.
Yes. I've been interested in political kinds of, you know, public policy kinds of issues for quite a long time, and so. A number of years ago, I knew several women that we had in Missouri, which is where I lived at the time. There was a group, I think it was called the Women's Something Network, Missouri Women's Network, maybe. And it was representatives from a lot of different organizations. And they knew that I had a long dress because I was active in the Jane Austen Society. And so they asked me, they really wanted to just hear something like this, what I just performed. And they said, "You have a long dress. Why don't you just do a little something about, you know, Susan B. Anthony." And so I did. I was asked more by other people to do that same performance. And so I continued to, but I was wearing that Jane Austen dress, which if Susan Anthony had really worn that, everyone would have known she was at least 40 years out of date. I felt very self-conscious about that. And here I am talking more about the clothes, and I probably shouldn't be, because anyway, my oldest sister then made this costume for me. This is from about the 1880s, probably. So, I mean, really, considering how long Susan Anthony worked, spoke, and worked for women's rights, the 60 years, there's a big range there, so you can go with a lot of different styles. Oh, the question was, what is my thinking about the Susan B. Anthony dollar? I don't have a whole lot of... I think there are plenty of other opinions that are probably better. I mean, I think it's wonderful that she was recognized in that way, and I think it's too bad that the dollars seem to fail as far as, you know, really working out well.
At the very end of your talk, you talked about turning the reins over to a lady by the name of...
Carrie Chapman Catt.
Catt. Okay. I have seen that. There's a building named after her up on Iowa State University campus. I never did know the history of it. Do you know any further history on her? And I realize it's taken away from your talk, but...
I'm going to have to see that building. I know that she was born, or I shouldn't say she was born. I believe she was born in, is it Charles City? She was born in Iowa. I'm getting some good, getting some help here. And I know you can go and visit her house there in Charles City. And she lived a number, I think she lived most of her life in Iowa. And when I said that Susan Anthony turned over the leadership to Carrie Chapman Catt, Carrie Chapman Catt is considered the founder of the League of Women Voters, which basically started just as at the same time that that women gained the right to vote. And so so we're very proud that she's from just across the river, basically. Yeah. Yes.
Could you talk a little bit about your research process? Did you know anything about her when you started, and how did you make choices about what to include in the presentation, and perhaps the aha moment or the most important thing you learned?
That's a great question, and I still question myself a lot. You know, am I putting too much emphasis on her early life? Am I not? You know, that's really hard, because there have got to be millions of pages out there that tell about Susan Anthony, her speeches, her writings, her life. And so it's very hard. You know, I wanted to keep it to under 30 minutes, but there was just a lot of different reading that I did, and sometimes I just couldn't resist putting something in. But it was more that than... And I have to apologize, because I don't think sometimes some of the way I wrote this... and you notice I pretty much read it exactly the way I wrote it, because I like for it to stay within the time period, but I'm also afraid that I'll end up saying something that's even more inaccurate than I might be saying. So when I say I don't feel like I'm completely accurate sometimes, for instance, in that there was a part where I said she refused offers of marriage, which she did. You know, I don't know. I know she had more than one, so I know that. And I don't know that it's true that she... didn't marry these men because she felt they didn't, you know, that they agreed with the prevailing wisdom. I'm not, you know, I don't really know that for sure. It's just that it fit better in the narrative, you know, so sorry about that. But, I almost am finished reading about her, because I'm so tempted to put more stuff in there, you know. And that's terrible, because when people ask me, you know, more questions about it, it's like, I don't know. You know, maybe somebody here does.
Just two comments. The first one is, Susan B. was very fortunate to be born into a Quaker family, because the Quakers were the only religion in America at that time that believed in women's equality. And the second comment is, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments completely disillusioned Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Susan B. Anthony, and all of the other feminists, because they believed that the Civil War had put it beyond even woman suffrage, that they should be talking about equal rights for everyone and not be that specific. And the third one was, there was a terrible split in the suffrage movement between those that believed in a national amendment to the Constitution, and those that believed that it should be done state by state, leave it up to the states to do it. And that schism in the suffrage movement was not rectified until 1890, when both wings of the suffrage movement came together. And Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, in some ways, may have compromised some of their more feminist principles for the greater good, maybe, of the suffrage movement by restricting what they were talking about, because at that time they were talking about
Ma'am, inequality. Can I bring you along with me to all of the every time I do this so that you can...
The inequality.
There's all, and that's what
jobs.
I'm talking about. There's,
yes, the inequality in jobs.
Yeah.
Divorce, the inequality in religion. And in fact, poor Elizabeth Cady Stanton almost got drummed out of her own organization because she headed up the development and the publication of the Woman's Bible. And anyone who hasn't read that, that is really, really an eye-opener.
Thank you for helping me illustrate how difficult it is to go through to even, you know, to know this information and to have to decide where to, what to leave out, and an awful lot gets left out.
I just learned recently that my grandmother attended Bellevue College in 1906, and the only documentation of it, her name was listed at the bottom of a bulletin. She was not enrolled as a student, but was that something that probably, they were from a wealthy family, was that something that occurred at that time?
Yeah, that's my understanding. That, and I think that some women, that, depending on the college or university, there were a few women who were able to actually attend university and get what we would call a real degree.
Yeah, she studied piano, but she got homesick and went home. But her younger sister attended a dental college here in Omaha, and she was about four years later. Mm-hmm. And like I said, they were from a very wealthy family, and they were very progressive. I often wondered if that had something to do with from this movement, if that's why they were able to do that.
That was part of it. And you can imagine how much turmoil there was for years and years. And as the other lady was talking about, the turmoil and within the women's groups who were trying to achieve suffrage, but so much more. It wasn't just we want the vote. There, as I had said before, there were just so many rights that women didn't have. They were not considered real, true citizens, but subjects. Yes.
I was wondering how she supported herself as a single woman, and you know there wasn't any pensions or social services to speak of.
Perhaps I should somehow add that. But it's and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it's my understanding that people paid often, and this depends on you know which part of the 60 years where she was working on this. But I'm sure at first nobody paid to come and hear her speak. Later on, there was some of that, but there was help from there were like basically donations from people who believed the same way. And as I forgot to also say about the Quakers, because I think there was a lot of help from the Quakers. That was definitely a group of people who you know when I mentioned Reverend Antoinette Brown. She could call herself Reverend as a woman because there was that wish for equality. And so, but it was donations, and it was, I can't remember when she gave up, well, it does say when she gave up teaching, but her sisters also helped, and other people was all just kind of a cobbling together of monies. Get that done.
You mentioned in 1862 that Susan B. Anthony and 14 other women actually did register to vote and voted. As far as you know, were those votes actually counted, or did they go in there and cancel out that particular polling place?
I wondered about that, too, and I don't know the answer, but don't you think if it's a secret ballot, must have counted.
In which case, women actually started voting a lot longer before than 1920.
Yeah, I'm guessing none of the... Nothing on the ballot was close enough that it would have mattered, I suppose. Yeah, there's a question back there.
How many times was she jailed, or do you know?
I don't know. I thought it was just the one time she was arrested, and I don't think she actually spent any time in jail, you know, because she refused to post bail, but her...
Of course, Sacagawea happened to be one of the first women to vote when she decided what they were going to do when Lewis and Clark were going west.
Very good. The reason I've got this, when it looked like there would be no questions, and thank you for all of your questions, I really and your answers, I appreciate all of that. When I spoke here a couple of weeks ago, one of the questions was, what is a good book? Can you recommend a good book? And I'm sure several of you here could. Let me know if this is a good one to recommend. It's called Sisters, The Lives of American Suffragists, and it's by Jean H. Baker. So if there were women here from a book club and they decided to read that one. So
I do believe it is available in the Durham Museum shop.
Perfect.
So it's a fine book to purchase.
I do know there's only one copy.
We'll get more. What's that?
There's several.
Okay.
Good books on the subject.
Yes, there are several good books on the subject, absolutely.
All right, thank you, Linda, very much for being part of our programming.
You've been listening to a program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Linda Duckworth, past president of the League of Women Voters of Nebraska. The title of her presentation was Lady Arrested for Voting, Susan B. Anthony, the Woman Who Changed the Mind of the Nation. Miss Duckworth has presented her talk in the personage and in period costume of women's rights champion Susan B. Anthony. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Sunday afternoon, March 17, 2013, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Shauna Forsberg, former Director of Marketing and Public Relations at the Durham Museum, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The next two lectures in the Durham Museum series will take place on Tuesday evenings, July 30th, and August 13th at 6:30. In July, Danielle Battisti, Assistant Professor of History at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, will present the second lecture in this year's Civil War series, celebrating the 150th anniversary of the war between the states. Her topic will be the New York City draft riots and the boundaries of anti-slavery sentiment in the North. In August, Spencer Davis, Professor of History at Peru State College, will give the first of two lectures entitled A Look Back at 1963. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 300 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Coate, thanking you for listening.